Well, hello, listener. Thank you for listening to yet another episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes, in which Emma Burnell, hello, Emma.
Hello.
And me, I'm Stephen Fielding, and sometimes with a guest. I'll say who the guest is in a moment. Discuss a novel or a play or a film or a TV series which has some interesting things to say about politics. Sometimes it's not always directly about politics, like Dirty Dancing, and sometimes it is very directly about politics. But everything is about politics, as we know. And in this episode, I just stumbled across this particular drama documentary, I think is how we should probably call it, while doing some research for a book on the Labour Party. And I was Googling somebody called John Landsman and just looking up things that he was involved in the 1980s. And on a blog, which I think John was associated with, called Left Futures, there is a blog post from 2013, which includes a link to a drama documentary that the BBC produced for BBC Two, that was broadcast in January 1983, about a couple of years before, in the life of the Labour Party. A very dynamic, challenging time. Lots of things were going on. The party was changing. The constitution was specifically changing. And looking at behind the scenes that was going on and why things ended up as they did, because the Labour Party did change constitutionally quite a lot in the very brief period in the early 1980s, so that MPs were subject to a greater say in terms of their members sort of reselecting them. The party leader specifically, and this is what the drama is mostly about, the party leader was no longer elected just by MPs, but by the wider party. So in that sense, it became much more democratic. And this was very controversial, and we've talked about a play called Limehouse a few episodes ago, which looked at the formation of the SDP, which was a direct consequence of the decision to widen the franchise, and specifically to give trade unions a bigger say in the electoral college that was created after that conference. So today we've got as a special guest John Landsman, who played a very central part in those events and is in the unique position to talk about not just the politics, but also how the politics was represented by the BBC, which obviously at that time and subsequently has been seen as not the greatest of friends of the Labour left, of the left in general in Britain. So welcome, John. Thank you very much for doing this.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Great. Although we have to establish that none of us here are near anybody. You know, we're all in three different locations. We're all socially distanced.
Thank you in particular, John, for being a first for Zeitgeist Tapes, which is the first time we've actually had someone who's represented as a character come and talk about it. we've had clangers experts and writers, but this is, you are our first actual character, and I mean that in all the ways that can possibly be.
although I have to say, there was a BBC drama documentary about Margaret Thatcher called Margaret, about the fall of Margaret Thatcher, and Ken Clark, as he did in the reality, is in that play. It's a very good play, and it just so happened that the day after it was broadcast on the BBC Two, Ken Clark was coming to the campus of Nottingham University, and I was due to kind of meet him to look after him. And as we're in my office having, you know, sandwiches and crisps, this was like my unique opportunity to ask somebody, right, you were in it. What did you think? Were you think you were done fairly? He said, oh, I couldn't be bothered watching. So I didn't ever get an answer. But John, you are the person we can now ask, well, what did you think about it? How were you depicted about the event? What do you think about the events that were depicted?
Remembering when I watched it at the time, it was faintly embarrassing. And of course, I was also asked to comment on scripts, you know, during the writing of it as well, because there was a lot of discussion between the writers and the people, the characters, you know, the real characters, because there were one or two composite characters in there, but the people who were real people. Were interviewed and And so there are, you know, there are things in there that, although it was very largely drawn from a book called The Battle for the Labour Party by David Cogan, who's recently written another book called Protest and Power, about a follow-up, kind of linking it to the Corbyn thing. And he was an advisor to the programme. But they also interviewed characters. So there are things like, for example, there's a scene in it involving Jock McPherson Quinn, who was an AEU engineering union activist, and there's another one involving the Usdaw executive. I knew Jock Quinn. I didn't know Bill Watley and other leading members of Usdaw, the shop workers union, that were played in it. And of course, I don't know the truth of some of those scenes, but people in them were interviewed. But you know, there were plenty of things in it that I thought were done reasonably accurately. Did it, you know, does that mean it works as drama? I think that's a different question. I mean, yes. I got it very well with the director or producer as well. And so I think to the extent that it did work well, I think it was more because it worked as a documentary, more because there's a lot of documentary in it, the footage, yeah. and particularly the narration by John Tusser, I think does work to help the understanding. But I mean, the truth is that, I mean, a lot of politics isn't very interesting, actually. It's boring. It's, you know, there are elements of drama, and the elements of drama are, of course, dramatized in the media. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it should necessarily work. And certainly the work of CLPD was really very difficult to make dramatic. And, you know, those bits are, looking back at it now, you know, they do look very tedious. But I don't think there's anything wrong with a lot of politics being boring. I mean, you know, the life of a political activist is not dramatic. It's not, or at least in their political role, is not dramatic. You know, there are some dramas, but that's not really what it's mainly about.
I mean, I wrote a book that was meant to look at how politics had been fictionalized, put on TV and whatever. And I totally had overlooked this. I'd never heard of it until a few weeks ago. But it's at the early days of when television started to dramatize real events, real political events. And it clearly is the drama documentary equation. It's more on the documentary. It clearly must be. So because sometimes you get things like, I don't know, you know, maybe we can talk about them later, things like the deal that Peter Morgan has done. And they all say, you know, and even like Vice, although, you know, that film about Dick Cheney, you know, based on real events, but some of this is composite or some of it is made up from this, that and the other. But you're saying they really took seriously making sure that most of the things, if not all of the things that were dramatized, were based on things that really did happen.
Yes, I think they really did. And in that sense, I think it's as accurate as a newspaper report, because, you know, newspaper reports are also, you know, partial and, you know, selective and therefore have an element of editorial bias, by which I don't mean you know, political bias necessarily, but, you know, bias based on the kind of understanding of the author.
I mean, I wondered it, because there are a lot of scenes in bars, because obviously it's based around conference and whatever. And I thought, these are very quiet. These are the quiet, I mean, were bars and were pubs really that quiet in the 1980s? So it seemed to lack a little bit of oomph. I think they didn't really seem to, they avoided any ability to dramatise. There was no music either, was there?
That's true, and I think the work of CLPD a lot of the scenes in this in it were set in, particularly in Blackpool, I used to have a lot of meetings in the lodgings we stayed in Charnley Road, Blackpool, and we'd be sitting on beds around a room, You know, and even when you go and, you know, I lobbied, you know, on the, there's a scene where we discuss lobbying the NEC overnight. And, you know, I went up to Tony Benn's room at about 11:30, 11:45. And, you know, he was in a kind of state of, well, not undressed, but he was kind of, you know, getting ready to go to bed. And, you know, you sat around, you know, you know, that, and it wasn't in bars because we were working. And I think the working behind the scenes at lobbying, at discussing tactics, at refining tactics in order to achieve our objectives, that goes on in meeting rooms. I mean, actually, I think it still goes on in meeting rooms. It much more goes on in meeting rooms of the people managing the conference. I mean, it's party staffers now and you know, met people working in the leader's office that manage conferences these days. I mean, there wasn't much conference management in those days by the party officially, you know, which is why you had real, you know, it was, I'm afraid it was much more exciting. It was not stage managed. There was nothing stage managed about it. And, of course, you know, that was done away with, and the argument for doing away with it was that it may be good television and good and dramatic and entertaining, but was it good for the party? And you know, I think that's a good question, but I'm not convinced it's worse for the party than you know, the type of thing that went on, for example, in the Blair governments, you know, which was, you know, battles through been in TV studios by politicians, you know, that were just as open and damaging as the contest. And I think the benefit of having those real debates out in the open is that I think political parties and the political process do benefit from real debate and real questioning and challenge to decision making. And, you know, the more, you know, real the debate is, you know, the less likely it is to be stitched up. Now, you know, you can argue that you know, good tactics, you know, will help, you know, may beat bad tactics, but and good organizers beat bad organizers. But I think it's more likely to produce a democratic decision than what we have now, frankly.
I thought what was interesting in terms of the way that the drama worked, the tactics were what were interesting. You know, the way there was an awful lot of supposed knowledge on the part of the audience. So I was was this 1981? So I was six.
Well, the events were 1980, yeah. But it was 1983. So it was only broadcast less than a couple of years. A lot of people watching BBC TV, they might have known some.
So they would have known some of the major players, but so I think there was quite a lot of supposed knowledge that they kind of brought to it. So yeah, most of the unions that we're talking about have since amalgamated and changed. Interestingly, Usdaw is the one that hasn't. And Usdaw seemed to get rather played. That was very interesting tactics. and yeah, what I found human and fascinating and the kind of thing I love to see in a drama was that, well, actually, if we take up the Usdaw resolution, that helps our cause, even though technically we're on different sides of the argument. And so it was much more the tactical considerations and the discussion of how the tactics work that I found really worked in the terms of the drama. In terms of the conference drama, I mean, clearly it was much more watchable and interesting, whichever side of the aisle you're on, whether what you really want to see is a speech by Eric Heffer or whether what you really want to see is that speech by Neil Kinnock. There was these big titan clashes on the conference floor that we don't really see so much now. It is much more stage managed. And I think there's got to be, I mean, not to sound all soft left in that, there's got to be a middle ground, isn't there? Somewhere between having a conference that's interesting and produces democratic results and allows members and more members to say, but doesn't actually end up with us all just looking like we're Fruit Loops at the seaside.
I think that's a little unfair because it was focusing.
Oh yeah, no,
it was focusing on the most dramatic points of that conference, and you know, much of that conference will have been policy debates that will have been less politically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is there's having a conference for the media and there's having a conference for the members. And I'm not sure, is there a way that those two things can be better amalgamated? Because I think at the conferences we had during the Blair years were just pointless as conferences. They didn't do anything other than showcase the cabinet, basically. And as a member, it was very, very frustrating that, you know, I was sent to go along and do things there at the National Policy Forum, what have you, and you never actually did anything. And if you just went, oh, well, it's just a nice way to see my mates at the seaside, that's one thing. But it's not what you want from a democratic organisation. At the same time, what I also don't want from a democratic organisation is just constantly being at each other's throats.
I think, can I just, because we've got a clip about what it was all about, really, that the drama brings home. So there was a lot of cabaling, there was a lot of manipulation, there was a lot of tactics, but what was it really all about? And there's a scene it's in a bar, it's mostly men. I think there's only like one woman ever, I mean, whether that's a part of the reality as well. There's only one female character in CLPD and elsewhere, in the unions, of course. And it's after Congress has decided it's going to extend the franchise, take away the exclusive franchise of MPs to choose leaders. But we're going to work out who's got the biggest voice. And it brings together. I mean, John, you are in this scene, or at least your avatar or whoever is in it. And there's someone who I thought was David Owen, but is never named, but in the cast list is described perhaps, you know, giving away slight BBC bias, moderate Labour MP who comes to you CLPers and starts to have a go, and then you have a go back.
Do we have a listen now?
The bloody beginning of the end. This sodding principle. You can't have the party machine instructing the parliamentary party. It's government by diktat.
The trouble with you, mate, is you can't take democracy. You want it settled over brandy and cigars.
Tell me you buggers aren't fixing things. Don't tell me there aren't some very smart operators. Some very nifty footwork.
Oh, well, we tried.
There was a time at these conferences that you'd never get two resolutions the same. Never see all these duplicated things. Things coming from every constituency, from Land's End to John O'Groats. Identical wording. Bloody pressure job, isn't it?
It's called persuasion.
The party is crossing a line. Fundamental principles are being smashed down.
The principles this party stands for went out with Keir Hardie. Maybe now we'll get some of them back.
Callaghan sold us down the river at that bloody commission. Healy should have stood up and said these are fundamental issues. The whole concept by which the Labour Party operates is being totally changed by bloody Bolsheviks. It's not on.
So, John, were you called? I mean, that's about the only time it gets really kind of tasty as a drama. You know, people shouting, and you're a bloody Bolshevik. One of those other voices was Phil Wildsman. As well. Is that a fair reflection, do you think, of the issues? Do you think the drama dealt with those in a way that, you know, is as fair as you could have expected? And is that how it really was? Did it really get like that?
I think it did get like that, yes. I mean, there were those sort of interactions. And, you know, I mean, occasionally I didn't have much time to go to fringe meetings. You know, I mean, I barely went to fringe meetings until I stopped being heavily involved because there was never time. But I'd occasionally go to a fringe meeting of whatever the right wing equivalent to CLPD was at the time. It changed over time. You know, there was often animosity to there. I don't think that scene reflected any specific thing that I can remember, but it certainly was, you know, a reasonable approximation to many conversations that happened between MPs and delegates. So I think it's fair, yes.
John, I mean, what I'm really interested in, this was a clear victory for the Labour left, and getting the system that you were backing. But it's the classic thing of don't be careful what you wish for, isn't it? Because in the end, it didn't work out. Is there a reason behind that? Is, you know, because it sort of moved fairly quickly on from that after, well, from when the drama was out, if not when the conferences were happening, to the Kinnock years, and then obviously it went completely the other way with Blair. Was it? It wasn't a different system by the time, because we elected Blair by the membership, didn't we?
It was still a college, and I think I can't even remember if Blair was Omov by then or not. I think he was, because I think that was John Smith, wasn't it?
John Smith got Omov for MPs, I don't think for the leadership. And Blair was elected by the Electoral College.
Yeah, maybe it was slightly later that it was that it became Omov. And so the Electoral College was very different. I mean, actually, you know, comparing, because I was also, this is after that that programme, but I was also very much involved in Ben's Deputy Leadership Campaign in 1981. And at the time, it seemed massive. Of course, it was the first election of anybody, you know, of a deputy leader or leader that was not by the parliamentary party alone, and so it seemed enormous. And there were fringe meetings all over the country, you know, for party members and at trade union conferences. You know, I was doing a lot of the organising of that, and it was very. I must have heard Tony Benn speak 50 times, you know, 50 or 60 times that summer, or that year, and it seemed massive at the time. But the numbers of people involved compared to the numbers now, you know, I mean, you know, of course, the CLP votes were cast at conference by the ordinary delegate. They were kind of mandated sometimes, not always. Unions, you know, again, a few had some kind of ballot, but most didn't actually. There were some votes at conferences, and so it was really a much smaller scale thing. And because it was an electoral college, that kind of dampened some of the differences. So, you know, it kind of, well, it depends how far ahead that you are, but it was 50-50, and so, you know, we were fighting for. You know, for every vote, and we knew we'd lost Newpey, which was, you know, it had 600,000 votes at conference. The right didn't seem to know, although I later discovered some of them did, and for some reason didn't say. You know, we were really and the MPs, of course, had votes, so it was very dramatic. I think now it's. You know, it's a very different kind of, you know, both technologically, but the scale is enormous. The costs are enormous in comparison to the number of people involved in every campaign team. The management of it by the party is massive.
Extraordinary now to think that there was such a backlash against giving members a say in these things. I mean, you just couldn't get away with it in this day and age. I mean, we argue about what shape that might take, how, you know, where the unions sit in that sometimes. But I mean, it just, and you know, there are many people who think we should have more membership representation than we do at present. But the idea that you would just, that it was fundamentally considered beyond the pale to give members and unions a voice in their party is extraordinary to me.
There's a character, I don't know who it's meant to be, but it's someone in the engineers union who says, because they're talking about, you know, conference has decided they're going to extend the franchise, so how are we going to do that? And then obviously the people that are going to form the SDP start talking about one member, one vote for obviously very self-serving reasons. And a character in this engineering union's meeting says, no, we can't have that. Omov would be a shambles. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. You have one member, one vote. And that obviously is how the Labour Party, you know, sort of elects its leaders now. And so, and you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a kind of, it's now a historical document, obviously. And if I was teaching the Labour Party at university, I might be inclined to put this on to get people to think about it.
I would say about Omov, I think you've really got to recognise that trade unions were quite different. They were, you know, the affiliation of trade unions at a local level was very real. I mean, some, you know, constituency parties were dominated by trade unions, but not because someone had organized for a lot of affiliations, which is the only circumstances in which you get a lot of affiliations now, but because they represented factories and mines and, you know, and so on. Mm-hmm. And And they were, you know, they were a real link. And I think that members, you know, there was a much more sense that everybody was involved in a union, was part of a collective. Block votes did not seem wrong, you know. And as you know, the reality now is that the trade union link at a local level is less meaningful, I think, unfortunately. I wish it wasn't. And so I think the case, over time, the case for OMOV greatly increased. And I think for David Owen and Shirley Williams at the time, it was much more opportunistic. But I mean, in the end, you know, it was, you know, the left was arguing for OMOV. You know, that, and I don't think that was partly opportunism. It always is a factor, but it was also that the union link wasn't as threatened by it because the union link had become less meaningful at a local level. I still think it's important at a national level, but it was only taken away by the Collins report, which finally ended the collective influence of trade unions, you know, in the party, which is now in the leadership election, which is now quite weak.
Yeah, I mean, they've got strength on the NEC, haven't they? But not in those directly elected positions. Yeah.
Correct. They're at the NEC and at conference, but not anymore really in the leadership election.
I mean, I think to go back to this is meant to be a drama documentary, at least that's what people now call it. And I think we all agree maybe that it's more of a documentary than a drama. But I just thought they missed a trick. I mean, obviously it was conceived maybe as an extension of BBC News. It's why John Tusa's there explaining things. It would have been just before Newsnight. So maybe that was the audience they were going for. But I'd have thought, I mean, if they were making it today, it's a David and Goliath story, isn't it? I mean, the opening scene is in Vladimir Dera's room in his house with a few people. John Lansman, the first time we see him, is struggling with a photocopier. It's a few people, and you know, you're seen driving up and down to Blackpool in a battered old van with some really manky little CLPD sort of, you know, signs. I mean, it's a very small number of committed people who are against, you know, political giants, you know, Dennis Healey, you know, Jim Callaghan, and it kind of almost. And some of the votes were really, really tight, weren't they? You know, they were dramatic votes and people were getting vituperative. Some of the speeches, you know, Joe Ashton, a tragicomic turn, you know, things were being said. And it kind of made it boring.
Is that 40 minutes that we moaned about having liked the rest of Peterloo, where they just go from pub to pub having meetings. And it focused a lot more on those details rather than on the drama. So, as you say, much more documentary than drama.
I mean, I think
there were some examples. I mean, you mentioned the AU, the engineering union a guy who I knew. Jock McPherson Quinn was his name. And he worked actually in TV studios. I think it was
London Weekend. I noticed that.
I wondered why he had that. I thought it was some kind of an in-joke about the BBC.
But, you know, it showed, you know, you actually had, you know, there was an internal democracy within the AU. Actually, the engineering union was, you know, had extensive democracy, lots of elections, lots of structures. But there were rival centres of power. There was the delegation that was elected, and there was the executive that was elected, and there was a national committee that was elected. And, you know, the national committee was controlled by the right, the delegation was controlled by the left, which is why Terry Duffy didn't allow the delegation to vote in the decision about which electoral college they should back. But it was real trade unionists getting involved. And I think the Usdaw executive meeting, you know, where they decided, you know, they were oscillating between, you know, should we have no change, which is what we previously voted for, or should we vote for the biggest. Effectively the same thing that CLPD was campaigning for. And the reason that we've gone for the bigger share for the unions was because we actually saw the possibility that a trade union that regards union influence as being solidifying, conservative, you know, rooting the party in, you know, mass organizations as being, you know, that, that we thought that would be seen, you know, that could be picked up by an unexpected union, which turned out to be one of the biggest, the fifth biggest. And, you know, and once they did it, you know, we obviously then wanted to mobilize behind that. It wasn't, you know, the most important thing was winning an electoral college, not what the proportions were.
Mm. But at that point, towards the end of the drama, and also of the actual events, it becomes a bit like a comedy, doesn't it? That, you know, people on the right are backing something that's on the left because they think that's going to fall, so they'll get their way, and so it all just falls apart for the opponents of 40-30-30, given the union's 40%, and they look.
But there was also injustice. I mean, there were references to, I mean, again, in the conversations within the engineering workers with Jock Quinn about the lost votes. You know, Hugh Scanlon 1 year cast almost a million votes the wrong way. I would say deliberately. And that prevented mandatory reselection happening for another, I think, 3 years. So, you know, it's there were tricks and, you know, dirty tricks, and this was not dirty tricks. This was tactics and planning and lobbying and organizing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that happens now big time. To the extent that it eliminates democracy.
And the fact that the you know, the moderate MP, just known as Mr. Moderate MP guy, is so shocked by the fact that people are organizing and that you it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, and yeah, dude, you've got out organized. Get over it.
So,
which actually, when John Golding wrote his book a few years later, I think he entirely accepted. But of course, by then, the union right had out organized us, and that's what really made the difference to Kinnock winning back. That's the answer.
Mm.
You know, actually tying up the union votes was what changed the control of the national executive. I mean, Kinnock won, I think primarily because Ben lost his seat and he decided not to fight a different seat after boundary changes in Bristol. And, you know, from that moment on, from the minute he lost, Kinnock was a certain winner.
That's for the future of this drama. Yeah. I mean, this drama ends
true.
with the winning of the vote. So the unions get 40%. The MPs, having had 100% once, down to 30%. And the CLPs of members having 30% as well. And that, of course, I mean, as John Tusser says right at the end, that had consequences that are not depicted, which is the morning after on Sunday, because the Wembley conference was on a Saturday. And remember in Tony Benn's diaries, he records, you know, a kind of an exuberant meeting on that Sunday that you'd won. You know, you were celebrating that. At that very same moment, there were, you know, David Owen and Shirley Williams and Roy Jenkins were all coming together to, and eventually William Rogers, came together to form what would be the SDP as a direct consequence of that. So those two events have both been dramatised in very different ways. Quite interesting, we could put them together one day.
Maybe you can do a double bill for your students, yes. Steve.
Yes, maybe. But given, I mean, just to end, I mean, I'm not quite sure whether we'll have a productive conclusion to this, but given those events actually, you know, that period reflects, echoes, anticipates, and is another playing out of things that we're more familiar with in the last few years under Jeremy Corbyn. Are we looking forward to Jeremy Corbyn, the movie? How he nearly won power. I mean, is James Graham or somebody going to be writing the 2017, you know, the campaign where it should have been a disaster, but it nearly became a victory?
And most importantly, John, who's going to play you this time around?
Well, Robert Gladys is still alive. But actually, I don't think that's very likely. I mean, I think my feeling about dramatising politics is that it works best as satire or, you know, comedy. And I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't great tragedy as well. Shakespeare wrote some very good political plays, Julius Caesar, Lear, you know, etc. But I'm not sure they were accurate. I mean, I have no idea how accurate they were. But I think, you know, in the thick of it, I mean, I think James Graham's staff is, you know, is great and really does get across. I mean, in the thick of it, you know, is hilarious, but there is something real, you know, very real about it. Alistair Beaton did a thing, Feel Good. I don't know if you know that, about the politics of spin as well,
right?
About Blair. And
there was a drama. I'm not sure James Graham wrote it, about the coalition, the formation of the Conservatives. And he did write that, didn't he? Right. Yeah. So if you can make a drama with there was comedy in it as well as some tragedy with Gordon Brown and about the formation of the Liberal Conservative coalition, I'm sure you could make a drama. James Graham wouldn't be beyond his gifts to do a drama about at least some aspects of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership.
I think you can do a moment.
Yes.
You can do a scene from it and dramatise that. The deal is the scene, is the deal between Blair.
It's Granita, yes.
Probably do the 2016 leadership challenge, either as tragedy or farce. I mean, depending on your point of view, really. Or a bit of both.
Well, we'll see then. I guess on that suggestion for James Graham, or somebody else, or some underemployed writer, that's our suggestion. That's our gift to you, whoever you may be. although we might want to copyright that, I don't know.
Copywriting things.
So, well, anyway, thank you, John, for talking us through that forgotten drama, which I think maybe we'll put a link on it, maybe on Twitter or on our webpage or whatever, because it'll take, you know, take people there. So thank you, John, for that. And thank you, Emma, for doing what we do anyway. And thank you, me, for chairing this. And given I'm sharing the thanks, I should remind people that we should thank Lord Stuart Wood for our theme tune. That this has been, remind you, this has been a Political Human production, and that whatever platform on which you hear this, please, listener, rate and review.